One thing that most of us take for granted is that the product is going to be used somewhere. The piece of equipment's going to be installed in some facility or room or even outdoors. It could be under the sea, it could be outer space, it could be on a mountaintop, or it could be in somebody's kitchen. Each of our products sees a unique set of stresses, and in part, those stresses are caused by where they're located. Just simply sitting on a storeroom shelf can lead to a number of different failure mechanisms for many products. But the other part of this is how it's used, and we'll explore each of these just briefly, as it's part of the considerations that we need to bring to the table if it's not already there for the design and development process. The environmental factors and environmental and use factors can be broken down into many different ways of classifying it. When I was at Hewlett-Packard, we had, I think, six different environments, from a computer room with the raised floor and dedicated cooling systems and very clean power provided to the servers and equipment in those rooms, to outdoor portable, like a PDA or a phone or a camera would be used outdoors and would be subject to drop and so on. So even just on vibration and shock and drop, the different environments would have different sets of requirements. So inside the organization, we had a environmental test manual, which was more than just a sequence of tests. It was, well, what are the set of conditions for these different environments, from computer clean room to home and office environments to outdoor portable, and to, and I think there was three or four other variations of that. But for your products, what are the typical sets of stresses that characterize where your product is being used? That's the environment. It's the weather and the other aspects of that. But it's also how it's used and what's the day in the life like for your particular device. So it's the environment is often considered to be temperature, humidity, is it going to get rained on, or what kind of humidity is it going to see? But it goes on to quite a few other things, like insects. I understand there's a facility in Texas that tests specifically for fire ants. Not that I've ever want to have a product or go do that test, but it's possible that insects can be a significant threat to your product. As an aside, apparently fire ants like low voltage fields and will eat through just about anything to get closer to the where that field is emanating from. And so for power monitoring and power meters things for like your home or business, in Texas, they would often be placed in an underground chamber as it was fed. The power was underground, fed into the home or business. And the fire ants would discover this and then eat through insulation and seals and everything else, and then exposing, not only causing damage directly to the unit, but allowing moisture and other contaminants to enter the device and cause its failure. But there's also, how is it handled? What kind of shipping and installation processes are there? Is it on a dolly going over concrete steps, or is it using a forklift? What kind of shock and vibration will affect a product and cause damage to it? I worked with one team that had a 50% dead on arrival, and it was due to some of their novel ways of creating components on their systems. They would stack them up and tip them against each other, and not using conventional or standard approved soldering techniques, but they felt that they had to do that because of the nature of the product. Unfortunately, those systems were not designed to handle anywhere near the shock and vibration that was typical for the shipping that they were going through. Hence, some parts would just fall off their boards and due to that vibration loads of just transport and cause their really high field initial turn on and field failure rates or that happened early in that product's use. But there's also customer use. You know, I know I've dropped my phone a couple of times, maybe four or five times. And each time I've been lucky and it hasn't really caused any serious damage to the phone. Whereas my daughter seems to, and even though claiming she's never dropped her phone, the screen of it is very often cracked and damaged. I think the last, not the current phone, but the previous one lasted, I think, for almost a year with packing tape basically holding it together. Now, sometimes it's normal use, but sometimes it's misuse. And so going back to those phones, the iPhones have a small moisture sensor. And I don't know about the newer ones, but the older ones, you could see it inside the connector, the power and communication connector, that the USB connector, basically. And you could see if there's a little area that was turned blue, then the Apple folks and the people looking for failures and causes of failures for your product could sense that it had seen a significant amount of moisture, usually dropped in some water. Now, it's not covered for immersion in water, and that's why that sensor was there. But there's also the notion that our customers continue to push our products into new environments, into new situations, not to mention that this notion of global warming or environmental change is the environment itself is changing. And so what our systems are capable of withstanding today are very likely to be pushed to their limits in the future. So it's not just weather, it's electrical power, it's insects, it's fungus and molds, it's wind, all the weather type stuff, but it's also electromagnetic emissions from nearby products or systems. And that list just goes on and on and on. So take a careful look at all of the different stresses which could cause your product to fail that you're going to do something about. Now, a great many products will fail due to a direct lightning strike, but it's usually not cost effective to make your product direct lightning strike capable and to be able to withstand that because the frequency is so rare. And so it's pick and choose those stresses and those elements of where your product's going to be used that you really do need to make it robust and make sure that the design is capable of creating products that are robust to all of these different environmental conditions. So next is the use part of it. And the easiest one to think of is an aircraft. So there's a use condition when it's taxiing and getting loaded and people are getting on the plane. Then it taxis some more, and then it goes through a takeoff sequence, and then it goes to level flight. Then it's a descent, which puts different stresses across the airframe. And landing has its own unique set of stresses, and then taxiing again. And it could be in different, completely different environments. It could be going from a hot, humid environment up into the mountains and cold, dry areas, maybe a couple times per day. So not only is it the how often it takes off and lands, it's also the different elements of its mission, profile is the way the military folks would talk about it. So is it a vehicle? Has it got different modes of operation? It's rough terrain or on street traffic, and so on. When I was with Hewlett Packard, I worked with the inkjet printers, and the nozzles themselves have, 20 or 30 different ways that they can fail. And some of the failure mechanisms depended dramatically on how often that color of print of ink was used. So if it's used quite a bit, there's a phenomena called captivation where a little air bubble collapses with a significant amount of force back onto the bottom of the nozzle. And it would, over time, that crashing of that collapsing of that air bubble will cause damage to that surface and cause pitting and erosion of that. But if it's not used very often, then that failure mechanism is not likely to occur. On the other hand, if a particular nozzle is not used very often, And depending on what kind of ink and chemical system is used, it may actually create small crystalline structures that clog the nozzle, and again causing either problems with the quality of the printing or blocking that nozzle completely and causing problems with the print altogether. Completely different failure mechanisms, but dominated by the how they're used. So if it's used fairly frequently, the crystal formation just never has a chance to get large enough to cause any problems. On the other hand, if you don't print very often at all, then the damage due to the air bubble cavitation is not going to happen either, not cause enough damage. And there were 20 or so other failure mechanisms that each had a small part, and most of them had some relationship to how often the system was used. But when you think about your product, think about it from the time you pack it at your factory and get it ready for shipping. There's storing and transport and distribution, and there's possibly opening and closing of containers. There's the final installation, getting it out of the box and installed, say at a home or a business, for example. And then the initial power on and maybe a calibration cycle depending on the equipment, and so on. How does all of those different environments in together or separately create different failure mechanisms for your product? And so the frequency of something being moved, for example, an inkjet printer, increases its chance of being dropped. Well, if the printer is small and lightweight and easy to move, it may well move more often. Whereas a big office printer has its own stand and wheels, well, how often is that going to be rolled around and moved? And how likely is it to tip over? And those kinds of factors. So think through all of those different scenarios for your particular product, and then you can start identifying all of those different risk factors. Now, part of this goes into the risk analysis tools that we'll use, but it's also a way to make sure that we don't miss anything that can damage our product significantly before they actually even get to the customer in some cases. Now, I mentioned earlier that when I was at Hewlett-Packard, we had an environmental manual, an environmental test manual. And the military has one, and I think you can see the different types of environments and some of the different standards and documents, like ground benign, for example. But there's also, for your products and for your industry and your materials and so on, you may have different types of environments that you create products for. Some might be in a control room where the others are in the factory floor. And each will see very different sets of stresses. So separating those products and those requirements and documenting that. But not just the min and max, also document the spread and the shape of that particular stress. Is it a bell-shaped curve or a triangular curve or skewed in some way? Gather the data so that you can have a pretty complete picture, if not just a simple histogram, so that the design teams and you as setting up reliability work have a complete set of data of which to characterize the different environments that your products are going into. And the environments do change, and we learn more all the time. The different technology responds differently to the different environments and different elements of an environment, but most of it stays relatively stable. The types of temperatures in the home and home office are relatively constant and from one product to the next. So creating a document that categorizes all those things and puts them all in enough detail so that they're useful for the design team and for the product verification validation efforts, it can go a long way to being very clear in communicating what are the environmental and use conditions that these products need to withstand. So basically, one of the elements of supporting the design and development process is to know the environment. And if you recall, one of the elements of the reliability definition is the environment. So we're going to have a product with a function in a specified environment. and that includes the use conditions. So we can document that and make that information very clear, not only to our reliability, for our reliability work, but also for all the decision-making that goes into creating a product. Next, we'll take a look at the tool that more often the mechanical engineers are very familiar with, but the concept applies to most anything that we put into the design and development process, the concept of a stress-strength analysis.